Game Brain, a board game podcast about our gaming group. I am one of your hosts, Tom Donnelly, and who do we have here today? But the other host making his triumphant return to hosting duties, ladies and gentlemen, Maddie Robinson is on the mic. How you doing, Maddie?
Welcome back, welcome back, welcome back. I'm back, y'all.
Yeah.
We're going to get copyright infringement on that Welcome Back, Carter theme song, but I am so happy to be back. I am so happy to be talking to my very, very dear, dear friend, Tommy Dean Donnelly, this morning.
Yep.
And, you know, it's funny because I think if we weren't in a pandemic right now, I couldn't come back. Because I still probably can't go to game nights with two young children that I have to put down, and I'm not free until 9 p.m. every night.
Right.
But the fact that we can play virtually, I can jump on my computer at 9 o'clock and play some board games. So, funny, I'm back earlier than I would be if we weren't in end times.
And that was not your estimate for when you would be back at all.
No, I really had no idea how tough two kids is. I totally underestimated it. No. I don't know when I'm going to a game night again. I mean, I do. It's when it's not a nightmare for my wife to put two children down at once. And, you know, when you have an infant and a 2-year-old, can't bathe them and put them to sleep. It's impossible.
I'm not sure if you recall me mentioning that. I didn't think that your timeline was.
I remember
what that was like.
I think when Joni's like, that's the infant. I think when Joni's like 1.5, then we'll be, you know, then Strider can kind of put himself down a little bit more. And I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see. It's going to be a while. But look, this is awesome because I can play virtually now. I could take a lunch break and play some games with friends. And I can, you know, if you guys are willing to wait till 9 p.m. for me, I can jump online and play for 2 hours before I fall asleep.
Yeah, my schedule has just become so, like, you and I wake at the exact same time. We wake at 6 a.m. Pretty much every morning. And we'll figure things out. I think it's awesome. I'm really happy about it.
So we are going to start double duty. We're going to start sharing, which I think is going to be a huge boon for the podcast in a couple ways. Because one, we now will have 2 weeks to review a game, to play it, to learn it.
Yeah.
Not that we were rushing before, but we will have more time to really get a couple extra plays in, to reread the rule book a few times, to really savor these games. So, you know, each of us will only have 2 episodes a month. And I think it'll be really good for the podcast outside of just, you know, having giving you a break. Your schedule got crazy, so I'm happy to help lighten the load a bit for you. And I just think it'll be better for everything. I think it's really fun.
I agree. Listen, it's been a long time. When you were last hosting this podcast, we were in, there is no exaggeration, a completely different world, a different universe,
a different reality
than we are in now. The number I was starting to put together a list of things that existed when you were hosting the podcast, and I just gave up. My God, I can't even. Yeah. When the great Chadwick Boseman died yesterday, as I was putting this list together, I just got so sad. I was just like, no, you know what, I can't even joke about how many horrible things have transpired. So maybe you coming back is our climb out of the morass that we're in.
But either way, I'm happy to be back, and I hope it improves the podcast, because you were doing a fantastic job, and now I am genuinely intimidated about not filling your shoes, but filling one of your shoes.
Oh, please, Matthew Robinson, you are a card. You've been podcasting for years and years and years, and it shows. You're a master of the form.
You've done an amazing job, and I thank you for, because honestly, this podcast would have died without you. So I thank you, and everybody else listening should thank Tom for keeping us alive for so long.
It's a blast. Listen, the format saves us, right? The format is
sure.
It is not.
You don't
just
have to book guests.
Yeah, there's no one host. There's a ton of hosts, and every single one of us has got a tremendous amount to give and to share. And boy, that makes the hosting job so much easier. Ladies and gentlemen, this is round 8, turn 6, and Maddie and I are going to talk about the 2017 release, Anachrony. And because it's Maddie, we're going to talk about foreplay, or that's what Maddie, that's what Maddie calls it. Really, is the joy of setting games up, which is something that Maddie and I have some very, very different perspectives on.
Yes, and we're not just going to talk about the setting up of board games, which I think there's a lot of joy and meditative joy to be found in, but we're also going to talk about how we store our board games, board game storage, inserts and organizers, the way we organize board games on the table. This is really an ep for, I think most of our listeners are usually probably the us in their group, right? I mean, they're the ones who are buying the games.
Yep.
They're the ones who are hosting the game nights.
Yep.
Most people who are going to be listening to a weekly board game podcast are probably going to be not the casual gamers. So I hope you'll find some good tips here. I definitely have gone very deep down the rabbit hole of board game organizers and table organization. And it's one of my favorite parts of the hobby. So we'll have a lot to talk about there.
And I take more of a doomsday prepper approach to board game organization, which is not to say there is no organization. It's just lean and mean. We got a little a slightly different perspective on this.
Yes. After one of your children eats a peanut butter and jelly out of a Ziploc, you take that Ziploc, maybe with a little PB&J inside of it still, and you throw your chits in there and throw it in the bag.
If that, I mean, really, I mostly use the hot sauce containers from Chipotle.
Oh, jeez. You keep one token, one meeple inside of each one.
You know, Dimitri asks, are you going to clean that out? And I say, after three plays, it's pretty much clean, so we don't really have to worry about that too much.
Oh, man. It's going to be a tough episode for people with any form of OCD at all.
No, they're going to get both sides of it. They're going to get the OCD heavy side. I think somewhere in between the two of
they're
us.
They're going to have to tune out for you.
They may very well.
Might give me an anxiety attack also.
Well, let's talk about last week's game night. Game night for me, I said this to you, and I want to say it on the air because it's something I feel completely true about. I miss gaming with you. I am gaming with, I'm gaming less than I normally do because of the scheduling and stuff that's going on right now, but I'm still playing games with everybody. I'm still getting out there, mixing it up, and playing games with people. You are the person that I played the least games with, and you know we totally understand why. But this week playing Anachrony with you, I realized I miss gaming with Maddie so much, and I'm really glad that you're going to be able to be gaming more with us. I'm really, really looking forward to that. Other than that,
I think you've just missed the joys of having a very weak opponent. And so I'm happy to fill those shoes for you. You get to just relax and know that you're going to just tromp somebody.
I had a couple good games.
I'm happy to provide that for you.
I had a couple good games this week. I was really happy with how that turned out. I was like, oh man, back in the swing of things. I loved it.
I love gaming with you. You are my dojo master, and it's nice for the student to return to the dojo and get beaten up by his master once again.
Please, I think this. We'll talk about it when we talk about Anachrony, but it fits my game brains like a glove. This particular game. It is exactly what I'm good at is what this game delivers. So it's going to be great to talk about. Also brought out High Society this week to play with the family. Oh my god, such a good filler. That literally, probably, maybe my favorite filler of all time. I just think that the way that the simplicity of that Reiner Knizia design and the meanness of it and the end game conditions of it. We talked about game endings last week, and I'm not sure I brought up High Society. I meant to, but I think we ran out of time.
I think you did. Yeah, Lease Money's okay. Eliminated. You guys mentioned it.
Yes. Oh, good. Good. Yeah. Good. Yeah.
No, that's so fun. That's that Reiner thing that you've got to always worry about the least thing. If it's even if it's in Tigris and Euphrates, he always has this the person who has the least is all that scores, or the person who has the least is eliminated, or I love that stuff.
Which is, I mean, I'm surprised more games don't do that, because there is, game designers spend all this time balancing their game, and you don't need to balance quite so heavily if all you do is in the rules. there is a rule that says the person that has the least of whatever the balance item is, right? Whatever the balance condition is, the person who has the least loses or gets a huge negative on their score.
Or that's all that scores. Yeah.
Right, exactly. The play self-balances, right? I think it's a...
I wonder if people stray away from it because it is his signature thing, you know? And it's like, if you try to do Reiner's signature thing and you don't do it as well, then you shouldn't have done it at
maybe,
all, right?
Maybe. I mean, he is imposing. He has designed so many amazing games over the years. But, man, if I was designing something, I might seriously consider looking at some of his classic designs.
No, Samurai. It totally self-balances, yeah.
Yeah. And then I'm playing a little Imperial Struggle with my son, and I'm absolutely loving it. Just that game is just killing me. It's, you know, it's the opposite of Anachrony. It is something that I'm finding that I am not very... very good at it. Now that I got a couple plays under my belt, you know, 4 or 5 or 6, I'm realizing
it's game of the year so far, right? I mean,
oh, it is.
I don't think it has competition at the moment.
No, it is. It's astonishing, and it's one of those games that you play it the first time and you think you get it. You play it the second time and you realize, oh, I could throw all that out the window. I had really no understanding of what I was doing. And now 6 plays in, I feel I'm worse at it now than I was when I had my first play. Oh, yeah. Just because it's got so much to it. It's crazy. What about you? What games do you play this week?
I mean, yeah, Anachrony's definitely been on my mind a lot. I played it 3 or 4 times. I played it solo a few times. And Tabletop Simulator is such a wonderful boon because you can play it solo on there and not have to set it up. And we'll talk about setting up Mind Clash games when we get into our segment. But it is not a short process setting up any Mind Clash game, especially Anachrony. So it's nice to be able to just fire it up on Steam. And you can play a solo game in like 45 minutes, which is pretty awesome. It would usually take 45 minutes to set it up. So that's pretty great. So yeah, that's mostly what I've been playing. And I've been getting ready for Versailles 1919. I guess we'll talk more about that in Games on the Brain. But that's I've been reading the rules for that and getting prepared for that.
We'll actually talk about that in the news. But yes, yeah. You and me both.
Sure, but yeah. Anachrony is all I played this week, and it's, up until this week, I've been playing a lot of Fort, and we'll be reviewing that, I think, with Paul. So, but this is the first week I didn't play like 4 or 5 games of Fort, so I think we've kind of maybe exhausted it a little bit at the moment. We'll see.
Can't wait. Well, you brought up the first news item, so what you say we just get right into the news?
Good evening, Mr. Listen off of South America, all the ships and clippers at sea, let's go to press.
Ladies and gentlemen, Versailles 1919 is shipping. If you do not know what that means, we are about to educate you. It is a GMT game. It is based on the peace negotiations in Versailles in 1919. Interesting point, before this game came out, like about a year ago, I was thinking about what movie could I write? What would be a almost one location movie that could have prestige, that could be really interesting, but could be done on a budget, that could, you know, something that has a, you know, a large payoff. And so I started digging into Versailles and the negotiations, the year-long negotiations, basically on and off, to end the war, to end all wars. And the level of contention that exists to this day about it, and the different perspectives on, you know, who was at, why was there another world war just a couple decades later, who messed up, what was the, you know, what were the real means and the outcomes of it. It's an astonishing subject. And then you find out that the game designers are Mark Herman and Jeff Engelstein, and take my money, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you don't know who Mark Herman is, he is, I don't know, the Stanley Kubrick of war games. I think that's fair to say. I mean, he's the designer of Fire in the Lake, Churchill, Washington's War, Empire of the Sun, For the People, SPQR. I mean, it's like, I mean, he's the Ryder Knizia of war games, it feels like. I don't know if I'm maybe overstepping my bounds there, but that feels about right.
No,
and then Jeff Engelstein, who's the chronicler of board games. I mean, he's sort of our... he's writing the textbooks these days. He's also a very accomplished designer as well. He did Space Cadets and Ares Project and Survive and a lot of fun, the Expanse board game.
Yeah, he's more of a Euro guy. He's a Euro guy. And Mark Herman is a war game, like, I think he's designed 60 or 70 war games. But But the one game you didn't mention by Mark Herman is actually probably my favorite of his, Churchill, which shares a lot of DNA. This is sort of like if Churchill has a Euro game designer come in and just strip out some of the chrome and just make it leaner and meaner is what it looks like.
And Churchill's a 3-player only game, correct. And this plays to 5.
Yeah. So did you read the rule book as well?
Yes, I did, and it is awesome. And it is definitely on the lighter side, which I think is really fun as well. But I think the decision space isn't light, but I think the rules might be.
No, I think you're absolutely right. When I read the rule book for this, I was starting to think, I was like, this reminds me of the experience of reading the rule book for Twilight Struggle. Everything that came before Twilight Struggle was very wargamey, and this one was like, oh my god, it's still wargamey, but it almost reads like a Euro, and that's what this feels like.
I've only heard good things. I mean, So Very Wrong About Games reviewed it a while back, and to say it was a glowing review is to put it mildly. I mean, I think they were saying it's the game of the year for them. It's definitely definitely exciting, and I'm really looking forward to getting to the table. And I have no idea how we're going to play, but I think somebody's putting together a vassal mod, so hopefully that'll help us get a game going.
Can't wait. Next up, you know what, Matt? We forgot game. We forgot when we were talking about game night. We forgot about the game that we played the most this week. The only contender really for Imperial Struggle as game of the year. Yahtzee has announced their Cup of Noodles edition. Maddie and I were lucky enough to get it to get advanced copies. We've been playing it nonstop the entire week, basically not sleeping. What can you say when you combine two of the greatest things that America has ever produced? Really, I mean, I think jazz is number 3 behind Yahtzee and
Yahtzee ramen noodles. Don't you want to be in the room when like the Milton, is it Milton Bradley or Hasbro? I don't know, one of those. What somebody goes like, all right, guys, what are we going to do with Yahtzee this year? And just like you pan over to the guy eating ramen noodles in the corner. Somebody goes, I don't know, ramen noodles? And they're like, done. Let's call it a night. Everyone go home.
So instead of numbers on the dice, you actually still have numbers on the dice, but you also have the shrimp symbol and the corn symbol and so on and so forth. And we've been having a really fun time on Facebook slagging each other off and complaining about each other's understanding of the Cup of Noodles Yahtzee game. But
we're not attempting to gatekeep anyone who may love Cup of Noodles and not Yahtzee, but come on.
Absolutely hilarious. You know what? I wouldn't say that this is the worst idea in the world for a gift for super casual gamers or family gamers or stuff like that. I think it's hilarious. I think the college market.
It comes in a ramen cup that looks very realistic. That's the cup you roll the dice in. I'm sure you could put all the pieces together.
I mean, isn't this the classic college game? I think that's
pretty much. I like Yahtzee. I don't hate it. It's the original rolling right.
Yeah. Yeah, it basically is exactly right.
It's only $14.99.
That's it. That's all it is.
Come on.
Eric Lang has stepped down or announced that he's stepping down from CMON Games. For about 3 years now, he has been sort of the overall game guru over there, overseeing a lot of their designs. And he's said that as of September 1, he is going to be leaving. There is nothing bad. There's nothing untoward. There's nothing unusual. He said, there's just, you know, just I want to get back to designing my own games, and put out a wonderful tweet saying, you know, hey, I love CMON. I'm huge fans of them. There's nothing sad or bittersweet in my departure. I'm just moving off to other things. And then he also wrote a note saying, and to all my friends in the game industry, I am not looking for work. I got plenty of things I want to design.
Yeah, no, I mean, and, you know, CMON also came out and said, like, you know, Eric Lang's very politically outspoken on Twitter. And so they wanted to make sure that everybody knew that this wasn't a reaction to his political tweets at all. And that they've been very supportive of that. It just seems like he wants to spread his wings and do some other stuff there. And you know what? That makes me happy, because I'm not really the target audience for CMON games. They're not really my jam outside of what is it, Lorenzo, right? I mean, didn't they do Lorenzo?
Yeah.
Yeah, Lorenzo and Magnifico, which is like one of my favorite games of all time. You know, not a huge fan of CMON games. Had my moment in the sun with Blood Rage for a couple games and enjoyed it, but wasn't a fan of Rising Sun. I am looking forward to his next game. Is it Ankh, I believe? I did kickstart that, and I'm hoping that that is interesting. I at least want to give it a try.
The miniatures for Ankh look unbelievable.
But yeah, it's Eric Lang's older designs that I really love, like Chaos in the Old World and stuff. So I'm excited to see what he does away from CMON.
Absolutely. Maddie, why don't you take the next item? Because it's all you.
Oh, yeah. Roll for the Galaxy is out on iOS. Now, I think Roll for the Galaxy is an incredible game that is probably mired down by the name Roll for the Galaxy, as I think it plays almost nothing like other Roll for the Galaxy. I mean, other, you know, Race for the Galaxy games or anything in that genre. I think it's a fantastic game on its own, and a lot of people agree with me. I know our group did not love it, but I think it's fantastic, and it is now out on iOS and Steam and everywhere else that games are available.
Yeah, just to be clear, I think it's fine. I think it's a good game. I just think that it does share a lot of the design elements, the iconography and the symbols and the goal of the game as Race for the Galaxy, and as the what was the other more recent one, the
New Frontiers,
and I just out of the three of them, Roll for the Galaxy is my least favorite of the three. But that's like saying, you know, which flavor of ramen noodles are you rolling? Really, that's
well,
really
the thing. And that's why I say I think it's sort of hampered by its IP, because while it shares the iconography, while it shares a couple of the mechanisms, I think it plays completely differently. I mean, like, the strategies are totally different. The resource management is completely different. The things you have to actually worry about are totally different. So
if it wasn't called Race,
if it was its own thing, I think it would be a monster hit.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think you're probably right about that.
But yeah, it's $10. It's a little on the pricey side, I think, for just to give a whirl. But I mean, if you love it, it's definitely a good way to get it played during the pandemic.
Yeah, it depends. You know, how much mobile gaming time do you have? I wonder about that. Like, our podcast, our readership, our listenership has, you know, took the dip that everybody else's did. Matter of fact, I think we dipped a little bit less than the average, but because people weren't commuting back and forth, the commuting was a lot of the time people were listening to podcasts. So for a little while there, we had a dip. I wonder if iOS and mobile, I wonder if mobile is doing better or worse now because of the situation. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess it depends on media it is, right? Because video games are up like 800,000%.
Oh, they're through the roof, but it's mostly console
and PC,
yeah. So we may be out and about less, and therefore mobile may not be doing as great. Tough to tell.
Totally.
Speaking of mobile, Alexander Pfister announced that Maracaibo app is coming out. Maracaibo Digital is going to be coming out by the end of 2020. It's going to be on Android and iOS, and that's a pretty meaty game to do on a mobile platform.
It is, and I'm wildly excited for it, because the solo campaign of Maracaibo is really fun and really worth everybody playing who likes Euros, and I think this will make it a lot more accessible. I know they said they're going to have the whole solo campaign on there, which is great. And I just think it's a fantastic game. It's one of those games that came out right before the pandemic for me. I got like one or two plays in person, and then I haven't been able to play it at all. I played it a little bit solo, but it's one of those games that if a game night came around again, it would be near the top of my list of things I'm really wanting to play again.
I wouldn't mind re-engaging with that game either. I don't love it. There were a few things about it that I was just, you know, nothing so concrete that I'm like, oh, this game isn't really good. It is really good. It's a really interesting design, but it didn't hit that tuning fork that I need to be one of those games that I'm just obsessed with. That said, it's a really good design, and I would love to play it more and just give myself a second chance.
Trey's point he made last week about it was actually rung true for me, which was that there is a level of frustration because if somebody's racing the track and you're not, it's a crappy feeling. Which that's interesting, because it's like, I don't know. That's almost one of those things where it's like, well, it's so good that you want to keep playing. So maybe is that not a bad thing? I don't know. Well, but I definitely had that feeling. Even when I'm playing solo and the bot's like racing ahead, I'm like, no, I've got my cool thing I want to do.
Yeah, well, he tried that with Great Western Trail and then found out that at the end of the day, the variations in tempo in Great Western Trail weren't quite as strong an effect as he wished they were. So, you know,
they are here.
They are here. Yeah, they very much are.
Oh, you can race it and you cannot. I mean, there is, you feel it. You feel somebody else racing it. Yeah, this is a true race game.
Yeah. I mean, to me, the better version of this, because what it feels like when you're going around the Caribbean in Maracaibo, it feels like what you do in the beginning part of Francis Drake. It feels
100%, yeah.
It feels like what you're doing in Lignum. And in those, you can race ahead, and then you are just foregoing everything that came before you. You can't hoover up all of these different resources and all these different advantages as you move around a track. But when a person gets to the end of the track, it gives them a bonus in terms of the next phase of the game. It gives them the first pick of some very important things to decide. And then the last person to get there is going to have the last pick, and they're going to be at a detriment, but it doesn't say, okay, the round is over now and things are done. So for me, that mechanism is just more satisfying, I think, for exactly the reasons Trey said. Also,
but for anybody who may want to have some second thoughts about Maracaibo, well, good luck. The first expansion is coming out, and you might find something here that you were missing.
The Uprising, it is called, as a matter of fact, and it's planned for the beginning of 2021. There's going to be a Native Rebellion in the area, and we actually talked with Alexander, and you know, and he seemed to express that this was going to have more representation of the natives in the land, and I think it sounds really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the Uprising is a title evocative of the indigenous people of that area rising up against the colonists, which is a welcome addition to the storyline of Maracaibo, to say the least.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to that. It's clear to me that Mr. Pfister is listening.
Yeah.
And wants representation to be a part of his design work going forward.
I'm very glad to hear that. Very, very glad to hear that, because we love his games and we want to keep on loving them and keep on playing them. But my favorite app news, which I don't generally like, is this one. DigiDiced is starting development of a digital version of Gaia Project. Gaia Project, one of my I think I ranked it number 3 in my game design in my top 50. Just an astonishing, astonishing game.
Me too.
And reading DigiDiced and what they're planning on doing, they're planning on developing it so that you can have async play, cross-platform, pass and play against AI. They're going to try and do an Automa, which would be incredible, tournaments and a campaign with 14 scenarios where you have to play every faction as you go around the game. Holy cow. I don't know when this game will come out, because the list of features that they're aiming for is amazingly ambitious, don't you think?
Yeah, no, and they know what they're doing. They've made some great apps before. I mean, they made the Terra Mystica app, so they've got some of the framework already built for this. But they Viticulture, which came out recently, which while it doesn't have the Tuscany expansion, I've been playing it because it's a really well done app. It's really clean and nicely done, and it runs beautifully on iPad. So I think they're going to do a great job. I'm looking forward to it, and maybe this will help get us an expansion in real life soon if it sells really well, which is all we want.
Yes, that's what we want. Please, people, We want more Gaia Project. Come on, it's so good. Yeah. It's the masterpiece of that genre, of that design stream. And last but not least, on the coming to app land, Game of Thrones is coming to Steam. Game of Thrones, the board game.
The board game, yeah.
Is coming to Steam. Yeah, the board game, I should have said that. Is coming to Steam. Planned release is third quarter 2020. So it will not be compatible with Mac OS Catalina, so I won't be getting it. But there you go.
The Game of Thrones board game is an interesting one because I think it's too long for what it is. I think it's totally imbalanced. I wouldn't want to play it in person, but I actually might want to play it on the app because they could tweak it. They can hopefully make some balance changes to make it a little more balanced and patch it. But also, it can play really quick, and it might actually be one of those games that improves when you can get it done in an hour.
Yeah, I mean, it took its design cues from Diplomacy, so I have a certain love for it because of that. But yeah, they ended up gussying up Diplomacy, and they didn't, in my opinion, make it better than Diplomacy. I would rather play Diplomacy. Yeah.
Lannister OP.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, there was a thing in the if you play the first edition, Lannister is not OP. Matter of fact, Lannister famously could be eliminated from the game entirely in the first two rounds.
Well, if you can't win or lose on the first turn, then why is there a first turn?
There you go, Yaron. Thank you. Thank you, Splatter. We're running out of time here, but we have time for this. Elizabeth Hargrave's Mariposas, her follow-up to Wingspan, is out, and it looks gorgeous, right?
It is beautiful. Yeah, I mean, I watched a playthrough of it. It seems it's probably a little light for my taste, but which is interesting because I think it's a good step lighter than Wingspan.
It's tile laying,
but it's gorgeous and a wonderful theme.
Yeah. I think Wingspan is, you know, I think casuals can easily play Wingspan, and more casual gamers, I think family gamers, couples and all that sort of stuff, I think they would love playing this. I think it looks really gorgeous, and I hope it does really well. I think what Wingspan did for the hobby last year was huge, and I hope that it continues.
And the theme is the migration of monarch butterflies from Mexico to North America. And I love how specific that is, and I think that's an awesome theme.
And there's a variant to the game where four other people play the cost next door, and
the butterflies just slowly start dying.
They just destroy the habitats. Yeah, they're just everything.
Right.
Everything gets destroyed. There's a game called Hadrian's Wall, which is sort of a new sort of roll and write game by a fairly new designer.
Very loosely roll and write, yeah.
Yeah, it's not really roll and write, and it's not really just a straight Euro. It's kind of in between, which is interesting. It's interesting to check out. I look forward to finding out more about it when there's more to know.
But that's from Garfield Games, so that and with art by Sam Phillips, so it's going to look like Architects of the West Kingdom and all your games. It's going to fit into that sort of world.
Exactly. And speaking of Architects of the West Kingdom, there's an expansion to Paladins of the West Kingdom that's just been announced: City of Crowns. It's going to be coming straight to retail. There won't be any anything else going on there, but
Kickstarter, yeah.
Yeah, City of Crowns is coming out.
Yeah. That's probably, I would imagine, early 2021. I haven't even gotten to play the Architects expansion. I have it. I bought it. It's in the Architects box, but the world ended, and I don't get to play games with anybody. But I'm excited to try it, and also, of course, excited to try this.
It's sad. It's sad that that everything that missed the digital love is kind of just withering on the vine right now.
So. Yeah.
We have to get that going. And then last but not least, Alma Mater is out, is being released right now. You don't hear me.
Real bittersweet. Real bittersweet.
Real bittersweet. Some of our favorite Italian designers, Virginio Gigli, et cetera.
Did you know they've named their design group?
No. What are they called?
Acitoca. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Acitoca. Acitoca. Or Acitoca. I don't know. It's Italian, I'm sure. But yeah, that is their design group now. Okay. And I, you know, if it wasn't for the complete lack of representation in a fantasy theme here for absolutely no reason, I would already have this game. I'm sort of protest not buying this and same waiting way. For them to fix that, because I think it's egregious.
I don't plan on reviewing this. I don't plan on buying this or playing this, and it's unfortunate. It is unfortunate. There is a huge thread that was started by our own Jennifer Schlickburn on BoardGameGeek about this. It's in the forums, and it's called "Disappointed That Alma Mater Has No Characters of Color." And it is 21 pages long now, with tons of posts that have been deleted and pulled out.
Yeah.
You know, you and I have both said oftentimes that BGG is one of the sweetest, nicest, gentlest places in the internet, one of the few places on the internet you can go that doesn't feel really toxic. But I'm you know, when I look at posts like this and I look at the threads and I see the things that come up, I realize, well, maybe I had blinders on a little bit. I still do think that it is a safer place than many on the internet, but we have,
but maybe there just are no safe places anymore.
maybe not. There are still plenty of problems.
Toxicity has leaked out from the real world to basically every virtual space. And vice versa. So Alma Mater is a game that takes place in a historical period of, I mean, it takes place in a historical era, but at a fantasy college, not meaning there's dragons there, but it's not one that exists. There were people of color in that time in Europe. And there's just no excuse to make a game. I mean, look, if you're going to make a historical game that takes place in a place where there are no people of color, I ask you, why? Why you better have a really, you better have a good reason for choosing that as your era. If that is what you're deciding to make as your theme for your game, I'd like to know why. And then beyond that, if you're not going to have a historical reason for it, you have no excuse to have only white faces in your game. And I think people are starting to realize that this is not cool in 2020. You know, we can't go back in time and fix the games that that already have this issue, but we can demand from this point forward that publishers don't, and we demand it with our wallets.
And realize that these comments, this brouhaha that has come up about this, was started quite a while ago, and there would have been opportunities to, I mean, it would have cost money, there would have been, it needed to have been some redesign and such, but it wasn't really done. It's unfortunate. I look at this game and it looks like something that I want to play.
It looks like the sequel to Coimbra, right?
Yeah. Which isn't something that I'm just that I'm like, oh my god, how can I not play this?
Yeah, sure.
But it's still something that I just feel like I at this time in this moment, not gonna do it.
Yeah, plenty of other games to play.
Let's move on to happier things. Maddie, would you mind if I played you my favorite song that I play over and over and over again each week?
Oh, sure. I'd love to hear it.
Cool. It's so cool.
Someone should hire that guy to teach music theory.
They should. Anybody that can make Trey sound like T-Pain, I'm all in for. Maddie, what's on your brain? What's in your game brain?
Well, Versailles is on my brain. Pendulum is on my brain. That should be actually. I think it's arriving today to my house. I'm excited to try that. And the main thing on my brain this week is Microsoft Flight Simulator 2020. I have been bitten by the flight simulator bug. If you don't know, Microsoft released the first version of their flight simulator game in like 15 years. And it's mind-blowing. It's absolutely mind-blowing.
Maddie.
It is a photorealistic rendition of the entire planet Earth, and you can fly anywhere.
Right. Maddie, I'm going to ask you a question in two parts right now. Do you
go ahead.
Do you at home or at your office have foot pedals and a thruster mod?
I have an entire HOTUS setup, yes, Tom.
Of course you do. Of course you do. Way back when I was very much into flight sims as well, and I had some of that gear.
Oh man!
As well.
If there wasn't a pandemic right now, you would be at my office in the next hour, and I would. I mean, this game is mind blowing, Tom. It's photorealistic satellite footage from anywhere in the world, and you can fly there. And it's real time weather. Real-time air traffic, other planes that are actually in the sky right now are actually in the game. The exact weather and time anywhere you want to be in the world is actually in the game right now. People all weekend were flying through Hurricane Laura, which is questionably moral, but they were showing Twitch streams of people flying into the eye of the hurricane, and it was like exactly where it was in the world. And I mean, but just the fact that like, we're all stuck in our houses right now, and I think this game's a massive hit, by the way. You cannot find a flight stick for sale under $1,000 anywhere in North America. Because you can jump in a plane and go to Paris and go fly around Paris or go fly around the pyramids or go find your house where you live or where you used to live. And there's just something freeing about we're all stuck in our houses right now, and it's giving me a lovely virtual way to see the world.
That's awesome.
I'm also learning how to fly a Cessna, which is fun. I feel like I could actually get a Cessna right now and do it.
Oh, there have been documented incidents in the past of people who were flight sim people that have never done a day of flight training. There was a problem in a small engine plane where the pilot had a heart attack and they did it.
Oh yeah,
they landed. Yeah, it really.
I've had that thought. Like I've been like flying like an Airbus and like kind of learning the basics of it. And I was like, if somebody died in a plane, I could probably land it while being talked through. At this point, I at least know how to turn the autopilot on.
Oh man.
So yeah,
but
it's beautiful.
It sounds like you're approaching this game as a tourist, though. I worry about you. So have you landed in Paro, Bhutan yet?
I've done a couple landing challenges. I've done some high wind landing challenges. I won't say that I would have survived them if it was real life, but I'm learning. I'm definitely trying. I'm figuring out my angle of approach and when to get my flaps to 100 and my ailerons, and I'm learning all the tricks. I'm doing my best.
So when you're ready, Paro, Bhutan. It is widely recognized as the most difficult landing in aviation. It is there are only 17 pilots in the world that are cleared to land there. And it is just jaw-dropping Himalayas and a really, really tough approach. So have fun.
Oh, no, it's funny you say that. It's in the game completely. So there's a handful of like the entire world is there via satellite footage. You can go anywhere in the world, but there are sections where they've gone in and actually created them in video game 3D models. So they're perfect. And I believe that is one of the airports they have that's perfectly done.
Oh my God. Amazing. Amazing. Is it almost 200 gigabytes?
Yeah, it's 200 gigs to download. Takes about 3 or 4 hours to download, and they've been having some issues with downloads, but luckily I haven't had too many issues with it. God, I wish you could come over and try it. It genuinely, the first time I booted it up and got into a plane, I don't think I've ever been totally awestruck in my life by how good something looks. I mean, granted, I also have like a ridiculously powerful gaming PC, but it's mind blowing.
I have flown conservatively 5,000 combat missions over Iraq in an FA-18. It was one of those early sims that was just amazing. Everyone was like, "Oh my God, it's incredible how good this is."
Do you remember what it was called?
Yeah,
was it DCS
FA-18. It was.
Oh, sure.
Hornet, right?
Super Hornet, right?
Well, actually, no, maybe it was, yeah. But yeah, so carrier landings and everything like that. Oh, amazing, amazing. I loved it. I loved it so much. Dude. Used to do it all.
Maybe you just have to come over and try this. You just have to.
I'm just going to have to. I'm just going to put up a big...
Maybe I'll just like leave my office door open and you can just go in and sit by yourself and then call me when you're done.
I'm going to send you rolls of plastic sheeting and we're just going to separate the room into two. Oh, man. Oh, that sounds amazing. Well, guess what? I had something else on my brain, but now that's on my brain. Because yeah. You can tell I'm way into it.
It'll blow your mind.
Oh, can't wait. Can't wait. On my brain right now is I guess still Imperial Struggle to some degree. I'm just every layer I peel back from the game, I woke up this morning and I realized I was dreaming about Imperial Struggle because I woke up. Mm-hmm. I woke up with one of those things like I need a pencil and a piece of paper, you know, to write down the last little bit of the dream. Because in my dream, I had come up with a new strategy. I'd figured out a new way to approach the race for the forts. And I was like, ah, oh, I got it. And then I got up, I ran out into the living room of the house. And when I got there, I thought about what I was going to write down and I realized, oh, it makes no sense whatsoever. It only made sense in the dream.
Right. Sure.
It wasn't something you could actually do, but I got so obsessed with
forts, that your plan for the forts is very, very important. Gotta have a plan.
And having played an Anachrony and looking into all of the myriad of expansions for that thing and reading through in general what they are, that's seriously on my brain as well because I'm just like, oh, yeah. Boy. Some of these things, some of it is cosmetic, but the non-cosmetic mm-hmm. expansions, some of them look incredible. Just incredible.
Yeah,
so I'm done.
Absolutely. Well, we're about to get into that.
We are because we'll tell you that the Abyte challenge was not challenged this week, and that's all we got to say about that. We're talking behind the scenes. Some of us are talking about maybe putting together another Game Brain. The Game Brain top 50 seem to go very, very well, and so we're in discussions about exactly how to do it. But we're talking about putting out another one that may be the hidden gems list for us. That would be games that are ranked 500.
Good idea.
Yeah, games that are ranked 500 or higher. Well, you and I did an episode on that where we did our own top 10.
Top 10 games that aren't on everybody else's top 10 games.
Still one of my favorite segments, but I think it'll be great to sort of have a little ranked list of that. It's going to be a little trickier because, you know, once you're over 500, there's not going to, you know, people are going to have their own gems and there may be many more games that don't have more than two people recommending that mm-hmm. one. So it may be a shorter list than 50, but something we're looking forward to doing. But let's get into it. Totally. Let's get into the review. Anachrony came out in 2017 and took the world by storm. The designers are David Turksey, Richard Amon, and Victor Peter. And the artists, deep breath, try and pronounce them correctly, Tom. Vio Farkas, Laszlo Fejes, Laszlo Forgotch, Martin Kiss, and Peter Meslenyi. I hope I got those somewhere near close. And the publisher is the amazing Mind Clash Games. Maddie, tell us about Anachrony.
The theme of Anachrony is trading in the Mediterranean in the 16th century. And that's it. It's very basic. We've seen it a thousand times. Actually, no. It is hands down the weirdest theme. And this is the Zardoz of board games. This is the, I'm sorry, what? When someone tells you the theme of this game.
What are you talking? It's not that weird. You're
have you?
I've read
have
it.
Have you read the story?
Yes, I've read. Okay,
it's so bizarre.
The story is a little bizarre, but if you
that's what I'm saying.
If you boiled it down to the basics of it, you know, it's not that different than 12 Monkeys, really.
Well, okay, but so it's okay. If we want to ignore the actual lore and say it, see that's the problem. Though, if you ignore the lore, you're not really doing the story justice. So
the story is.
Is the world is going to end. An asteroid is going to hit the planet in a few eras, a few rounds, and we have to prepare for that. But at the same time, we have to put forth our own faction's ideology in order to create the new civilization after the world ends, and become the strongest faction in the new era. But the story is much weirder than that, because the world already ended. We live in an apocalypse. Time travel came, and time travelers came to warn us about an asteroid hitting in the future. But we also have been given the power of time travel, but that power has caused the world. It gets totally crazy. I mean, like, the story is beautifully bizarre. But basically, time travel exists, and the world's going to end soon. And you got to get out before it ends. But you can also get some help from your future self, because we have time travel. Does that about cover it?
Sort of, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, the time travel isn't really getting help from your future self. It's kind of, I mean, yeah, it is. But it's also fixing, the time travel mechanism in the game has a lot to do with traveling back to fix the help that you already got, right?
Right. It uses that fun time travel idea of, if you and I were sitting next to each other and you were hungry and you said, I want a burrito. And yes, then you opened up the refrigerator and there was a burrito, because your future self remembered to put a burrito there. That's sort of the kind of time travel we're dealing with here.
Bill and Ted's Face the Music just came out, and I just watched it, and it reminds me very much of that, where, oh, remember that we have to steal Dad's keys, okay, right? And yeah, and you can make that, and that's literally what you do. One of the early things you do in the round is you are going to pull items from the future and suddenly manifest them. Suddenly it's like, oh, wow, you know what? I'm going to need another engineer this round, and I'm going to need some plutonium or uranium or whatever. Well, guess what? I'll just create it from the future, and boom, now all of a sudden I have it. And the only thing
is... That's the fun conceit of the game. That's how you can sell anybody on this game, by just saying, okay, here's the concept. Ready? Any resource in the game that you want, you just ask for it, and you can have it. But you better pay it back. Your future self better pay it back, or you're going to be in trouble.
Yeah, without that, this is not that difficult a game to explain. This is a worker placement game where you are going to be getting more workers. You are going to be gaining resources. You're going to be using those resources to build buildings on your own player mat, which are also worker placement spaces. Right? I mean, that's really. And you're going to be researching technology so that you can buy really big things that significantly change the game, that you can put on your building Super spaces project. Instead. Yeah. Exactly. That's really all the game is.
This is a worker placement tableau building game, 100%. There is just a couple interesting twists to it, like the time travel twist, and then also the fact that there's a main board for worker placement and your own board. And the main board, you have to have a secondary step to worker placement, which you have to have a sort of a life support system, a mech sort of hooked up, because the, you know, radiated apocalyptic world can't survive. You can't live on it just as your own self. So you have to have a mech ready to go that you can place there. So there's a couple fun twists on it. But yeah, at the end of the day, it's a pretty basic worker placement tableau builder.
But it doesn't feel basic. It doesn't feel, I'm not playing on Mars. It's not incredibly Baroque. It's not. It feels like a Euro. If you played a bunch of Euros, you grasp the mechanisms and how to play the game fairly easily. But because of the time travel, because of the flexibility of that, and because powering up those power suits to go out and do those things is expensive, and you're basically budgeting your workers and trying to figure out how many of them are going to be able to go out and do the big actions on the main board, and how many of them are going to stay at home and take the actions of the buildings that you've already built. It's a very interesting decision space. It really is.
It plays 1 to 4 players. The BGG gives it a weight of 3.99, which I agree with, but the basic rules of the game are not the weight. The weight is brought from two main things. One, the massive asymmetry that is here, much like Gaia Project. I mean, you are wildly asymmetrical from other people, not only in your leader's power, of which you have two to choose from every game, but the four paths in the game, which are sort of the factions, they're called paths. Each path has an asymmetrical board that has different costs for buildings and a different sort of superpower. And then beyond that, you also have your evacuation condition, of which you randomly choose one every game. And your evacuation condition is something that you're sort of aiming for. It's sort of your end game condition. So all of that is where the weight comes from, all of the sort of chrome, in essence.
Yeah, yeah. I think that 4.0 is too heavy. Or 3.99 is way too heavy for this. I don't think the game is, I think it tells people the wrong thing.
When you have a really interesting theme like this, the weight goes up because more casual players are brought in, and you know, BGG has a system where the weight is decided by the users.
And there's a problem with weight as a component, because, and we've talked about it many times, it's because, what are we talking about? Are we talking about how difficult it is to learn or how complex it is to play? Those are two quite different things, right? And there's a separation. Let's just put it this way. It has the exact same weight as Indonesia. It has the same weight as, you know, I don't think that that's right. I think
it's the teach, though, is what I think of, really. And this is a long teach. I mean, I don't think this is any simpler of a teach than Indonesia. I mean, in terms of how long it takes and the attention required by, you know, the players at the table, I think it's a teach.
Yeah, maybe. Barrage and City Big Shoulders are right around the same level of complexity. I feel that
it's just a long teach because there's so many, not edge cases, but differences. Okay, he does this, she does this, this evacuation condition does this. And then, of course, the game is sort of split into two sections. There's before the impact and after the impact. So, you know, we're all sort of doing different things. Once the impact hits, you have to understand what that's going to change to the game state. It's going to change the actual boards. It's going to create the potential end game condition. So there's just a lot of, there's a lot of chrome.
Yeah, I agree with that. Let's talk more about what makes the game completely unique, which is the time travel aspect. So during a round of the game, you are going to, very early on, before worker placement happens, you are going to be able to take these triangular pieces, and you're going to be able to put them into the current time. You're going to take them from someplace in the future, and you're going to put them in the current time. And when you do, you get those resources.
Do you want to tell them about the timeline real quick?
Immediately. Yeah, the timeline is four spaces before the event and then three spaces after the event. So basically, you have four full rounds of the game to prepare for destruction. And when the destruction happens, all sorts of the board changes fairly radically. All of a sudden, all those worker spaces on the big board become one-time use, and then they're gone for good. And they also...
they become superpowers.
Yes, they give you great, huge extra benefits. So even though you may want the game to go longer, can you resist the temptation of going out there and getting that really, really great thing that's out there, right? Which is kind of cool.
Right. And that's also the end game trigger, because the game can go from 5 to 7 rounds. And what decides whether it lasts between 5 and 7 is how often people go to those spaces. So once all those worker placement spaces that are now one-time uses are used up, well, the game ends at the end of that round.
And just because of the variable player count, it looks like in 3-player games, the game is almost always going to end in the 5th round, just because you're playing with the same number of spaces, basically, as you have in the 2-player game, and you have a third player placing things down. In the 2-player game, it seems like it could end in 5. It's more likely to end in 6. And 4-player, I can't really speak to, but my guess is probably round 6. What do you think?
Yeah, I think 6 is typical for 2 and 4. Yeah, that's what I found. I think 7 is once in a blue moon. You'll see that.
Yeah, sort of an edge case. I would say that if people went really heavy building strategies, a lot of people with very heavy building strategies, I could see you using your workers on your own buildings to try and build up a huge score afterwards. It's interesting. Anyway, you take these warp tiles and you place them back in the current era, and you get those benefits right away. But then comes the anachronies, right? We're going to roll a die, and anywhere you have the most of those warp tiles, any one time period, any one era, any one more round of the game where you have more than everybody else or you're tied for the most, you're going to roll a die or you're going to take one anachrony token, right?
Paradox
token, correct. Sorry. You're going to roll the paradox die. The paradox die is exactly the same as the Demacher die, which is to say there is one space on it that says no paradox, one space on it that has two paradoxes, and all the rest give you one paradox. So it's very small amount of randomness in it, right?
Right. And the reason that you were rolling that die is because we are playing a negative area majority game. So everybody during the warp phase, when you're deciding what things you want, is going to choose anywhere from 0, 1, or 2 of their available warp tokens. They're going to hide them in their palm. Everybody's then going to stick their palms out, flip them over, and reveal what's in your palm. And then those go on the current timeline. And then next phase, when we evaluate the paradoxes, whoever has the most in each era will be rolling a die. And you'll roll a die for every era that you have the most in on the timeline.
And why is that bad?
You get three paradoxes, you get an anomaly, which is a negative building, a bad building. It takes up a building space on your board, costs you negative points if it's still there at the end of the game. And the only way to get rid of it is to send a worker there and pay some resources and kill that worker and remove the building.
So how do you avoid getting those? Well, you can build a time-traveling building. You can build up to three of them, actually, and each of them have a different range. Like, some of them can only go back one era, some of them can go back multiple eras, right? And when you use a time-travel building for that, you can pick up one of those warp tokens and return it to the supply. But in order to do that, you must pay back what you have borrowed. Essentially, you have to fix things, right? So if I borrowed an engineer, I have to throw away an awake engineer. There's an awake and a sleep thing as well. We can get into that. But you have to throw away an available engineer to make up for the engineer you got from the future. Essentially, you're sending them back to the future. Oh, that sounds like a good...
So, Tom, why... It sounds like a good movie idea. Tom, why would I want to ask for a resource that I then later have to just pay back? What am I benefiting from that?
Well, let's talk, there are actually several different dimensions to that, but let's talk about the main two. The main two reasons are, as you know, in most games, we start off games having a very little bit of an engine. So we're in need of things to make things better. So getting resources early in the game, you know, one uranium early in the game is way more valuable than one uranium later in the game when you probably have buildings and mechanisms whereby you can generate things that you need. So that in and of itself is of tremendous value earlier on. But also, right, one of the game's scoring mechanisms is time travel itself. When you travel back in time and fix the timeline, fix your own mistakes that you have done, every time you do that, every time you return a warp tile, you move up on a time travel track. And that starts at 0 and it moves all the way up to sometimes as many as 16 victory points, which is quite a considerable amount of
20 is the highest for one of the paths.
There you go. Yeah. That's huge. That's huge. So
that could be a third or half your score depending on the game.
Yeah, so I found myself in the last game, I realized, the right buildings, both games actually, the right buildings came out for my particular strategy. Just lucked out, just happened to get the things that I needed. And I realized, wow, that leaves me a bunch of other actions that I normally would be scrambling to do this or scrambling to do that. Suddenly I have all these other actions, and I realized, you know what, I need to start warping more materials into the past because I now, even though I don't need those materials, I want the points I can get by returning them, right? By cleaning up the timeline and doing that action. So it's very interesting.
And so one of my favorite parts about this game is the buildings. And when you first learn the game, you're like, ooh, time travel, all this fun stuff, worker placement. But I think after your first game, you realize oh, the buildings are the game. It's really the buildings you buy, the order you buy them in. Mm-hmm. That's your strategy. That's your game.
Yeah.
So many of the points can come from the buildings, and that's your engine as well. So, and I realized, like, why do I like that so much? And I realized it reminds me of Lorenzo Il Magnifico, because it's, you've got different buildings, but it's not just random stacks of buildings. Each type of building does a specific thing, just like the types of cards in Lorenzo do a specific thing.
And there are
Go ahead.
And there are four of them, four different types.
Yeah, exactly. There are four. So, you know, the yellow buildings are all time travel, and the blue buildings are all about water, which is the food resource to wake your workers. And the gray buildings are all about resources, and the red buildings are all the rule breakers. They give you superpowers or sometimes endgame points, or they boost the other actions. It's kind of the potpourri. The purple in Lorenzo would be it. So it's very similar to Lorenzo in that sense, is that you're sort of picking a few columns and making those your strategy. And that adds such a variability to every game. And that's what I love about Lorenzo, too. It's like, oh, maybe I'm going a green strategy this time. Maybe I'm going yellow. Maybe I'm going purple and blue. And they feed off each other and do an interesting thing. But you also realize you need a little bit of everything to get your engine going. And that tableau building is awesome to me. I really enjoy that.
Yeah, it is. And the variety of those buildings, I think they did a great, great job with them. There are some buildings that don't require a worker, that simply give you a little boost, like making it cost half to wake up all of your spent workers.
A nice design nod to Zolkin there, which, yeah, I appreciated.
Yes. There are spaces which require a worker, and then after you use it, that worker will be spent, will be tired. There are some where the action isn't quite as great, and guess what? As a little bonus, they say your worker, after doing this, is awake and can be used right away in the next round of the game. And then there are even some that are really, really good that once you use that worker dies. There's a little skull symbol for that, which is fantastic. A really, really, really well-designed aspect to the game that I thought was really good.
I agree as well. But also, the weakest buildings are worth a lot of points. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some really crappy buildings that the first time you play, you're like, why would I ever buy that? Well, because it's worth 4 victory points. And that could be 10% of your entire score. So more I play, the more I start looking at those crappy buildings, and I'm like, oh, that's a really good building. 4 points is no joke, and it costs the same as, you know, the 1 point building. So collecting those high point ones actually is totally a valid strategy.
I did very well. Both of my games, I built the resource buildings. I built the factories first. I had two factories were my first two buildings in both games, I believe, and used those resources to make sure that I was building. And I think I won most buildings in both of those games. It's a real it's a really strong advantage. It is an engine that benefits you in many, many ways. And even those, and you're right, even those small effect buildings can have a big impact on your score. Score is an interesting thing because there are so many different ways. There are a lot of different ways you score points in the game. There is the buildings themselves have point values on them. There's the amount of times you time travel scores you points. The way you wake up your workers, you can wake up your workers by spending water and basically hydrating and taking care of them. And when your workers come back to work, you improve your morale. Your morale is a victory point condition. Or you can simply wake them up and not spend any water, and then their morale goes down because you're basically whipping them or whatever. You're forcing them back.
You're not feeding them, yeah.
Correct. That slider right there is victory points. There is also super projects, which are basically technologies that you're going to develop, and those are victory points. And there are, is it 4 or 5 different conditions, victory point conditions at the top of the board each game?
There are 5, and no matter the player count, it's always 5.
Five things. So the person who built the most buildings, the person who can time travel the farthest distance as a combination of your buildings, various things like that. Each of them.
And those are friendly ties too, which is interesting because if everybody does it, then it cancels each other out.
Wash, exactly right. And then last but not least, there is an evacuation that happens, and that can be a huge amount of points. Up to 30 points in the game can be scored through evacuation. Maddie, tell me what the heck is evacuation and how do you do it?
All right. So at the impact happens at the end of the fourth round. And when the impact happens, we flip over this giant Zardoz head on the board. And on the back becomes a unblockable worker placement space. But the rule is everybody can only visit the space once in the entire game. And the last person to go there, depending on the player count, is going to get a -3 point token. So there's a little bit of a rush to get there, but you know, everybody gets to go there. It's just the last person to go there gets -3 points. And when you take that action, which only becomes available starting in the fifth round of the game, you achieve your evacuation condition, or you check your evacuation condition. So like I said, at the beginning of the game, you're going to choose a path, which is going to give you a asymmetrical board. There is a unasymmetrical board side, which is side A. If you played Eclipse, it'd be the humans, but they all play the same. Obviously, we would never play that way. We like asymmetry, and we're always going to play the most asymmetrical version we can. Well, so side B, they're all asymmetrical.
I'll just say that. I think that we've often talked about it. We've never done it, but we always talk about it might be really fun to play Eclipse where everyone's human. In other words, where everyone is exactly the same, and maybe that's a truer test of the best player. And so maybe there's I think that's the one non-basic reason to possibly play that way.
Yeah, but more as a fun experiment than as the ideal way to play. But so you're picking a path, then you're picking one of your two leaders, which is your superpower. Then you're randomly being assigned one of your two evacuation conditions. So evacuation conditions have two components to them. The top component is the thing you must achieve in order to evacuate. Now, this isn't one of those sort of co-op games or semi-co-op games where if you don't evacuate, you're eliminated. You don't have to evacuate. The game won't eliminate you. You could still potentially win. And the designer has even said on some boards that it is possible to win without evacuating, but it is hard because your evacuation score is probably going to be 50% of your entire score.
At least a third, right? Yeah,
up to 50%. It could totally be. It maxes out at 30 points. So the first part is the thing you must have a condition. So they're all going to be different types of buildings. So this is going to give you something to collect. So three of the yellow buildings, three of the gray buildings, three of the red buildings, three of the blue buildings. You're going to have one of those. A couple of them are different things, like have a certain amount of water or even have a certain amount of anomalies, negative buildings as well. If you have achieved that, you'll get a certain amount of points, but then you are allowed to check the second condition, which is where the bulk of the points are. And this is just set collecting of resources. So it's, you know, have the gold resource and the genius workers, or have the most super projects, or scientists plus breakthroughs, or just the amount of workers. And then you're going to score points for those sets, for as many as you have, up to a maximum of 30 points. So you must have your evacuation condition met in order to be able to check the real point scoring machine. And you don't spend those goods. You just have to have them. So it really does give you a path to chase. And it gives everybody a different path to chase,
which creates a really good variety of the way the game lays out, right? It's one of those things where you need to get engineers. Another person, they need to get uranium or something along those lines. And knowing that, I think that once we play the game more and more, you know, you always start off these games staring at your own board and figuring out what you have to do. And then once you get really comfortable with that, you start staring at everyone else's board and realizing, okay, he's got a really good chance that his first action, he's going to want to go to this space or to that space. And being able to predict that, being able to figure out what a person needs the most, really creates I think that's one of the things that makes really great games really great, which is that your ability to sort of forecast what might happen and strategize based on that, I think is amazing. And this game's got a lot of that going on.
Yeah. I think the last thing we talk about is super projects. So above each section of the timeline is a different super project. Think of a super project as a super building. It takes up two spots on your buildings, and it has a huge amount of points. They usually range from, you know, 3 to 7 points. And it gives you some kind of crazy rule-breaking power. Sometimes it's a new action space. Sometimes it's something that scores points at the end. Sometimes it's just an awesome boost to one of the actions in the game. But in order to build these, it's going to cost a lot. And it's going to cost a resource in the game that is only used for super projects, which is breakthroughs. So breakthroughs are another point, a place you can go on the main board where you're going to be rolling some dice. There is a die that has different symbols on it, like circle, triangle, and square. And there's a die that has six or five different strange symbols, like DNA symbol and people symbol and all these different things. And they're just random collections of shapes and symbols, but each breakthrough requires either one specific one. So let's say this breakthrough needs the triangle with the DNA symbol, or two non-specific ones. So it would just need a circle and a square. The symbol, it doesn't matter. So you have to go to these spaces and sort of do, this is the research action, right? So thematically, you're researching a super project, and you have to have the correct breakthroughs in order to be able to have it. But you know, there's a little bit of a fun gamble of, do I go for the exact one, or do I guarantee it and go for just the generics, but it's going to take more actions in order to get there. That's a fun little level to the game.
Is there actually a gamble, though? Here's my question. It seems to me like the proper way to do it is the first time you go there, because one of the dice you can choose and the other die you roll. So if you always choose the symbol with your first action and then you roll, you're either going to Yahtzee and get exactly what you need, or you're going to get one of the other two symbols. And then the second time you do it, you just select the other symbol. So you're always guaranteed to getting it on the second try if you don't get it on the first try. Yes?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. But yeah, you know, but if getting it on your first is a big deal, it's an entire action. It's an exosuit. It's, you know, so that's a level of variance and luck that some people might not like.
Watching somebody else hit
that can be frustrating.
Yeah, I totally agree. There is some luck in this game. This game, for all of its weight and explanation and depth, it kind of has a lot of design cues that are like, let's not take this so seriously. Let's have some fun here, right?
And I like that. And they've given you an opportunity to lower that too. You can play without the paradox die and just negative area majority always gets one paradox.
Yeah.
And I think they've balanced the research well, because if you don't get what you want, research is actually just collecting those is actually a totally viable point strategy as well, because that's the only resource in the game that scores points. They're worth 1 point each, but if you have a whole set of all three different symbols, it's an extra two. So it's 5 points for having three of them. And like we said, 5 points is a ton of points in this game. So even failing on a roll sometimes sets you down the path of, well, maybe I just start collecting these. I've had two of my games, I've had 10 points from them. And that's a lot, you know, it didn't take a huge amount of work to do. It's just sort of, oh, I have an extra worker, I'm going to go there and just get a symbol I don't have.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I built one super project in both games that I played this week. And in one of the games, I was saying to myself in my mind, I'm just going to ignore super projects. I have too many other things going on. And then as I was playing, I realized, oh, guess what? Nobody's taking the research actions. It's low-hanging fruit. Right. And because you can score points in many different ways, all of a sudden I was like, I don't even want the power of the super project, but those points are, you know,
yeah,
very, very attractive.
And a lot of times it combos nicely with your time travel too, because you can only build the super project that you are focused on in your era. So you can only build the one that you are in that moment. So if you have time traveled back in the past, you can only build the super project that's above you there. So sometimes you have to time travel already to pay back one of your resources. And then lo and behold, above you is a tasty super project, and now you can build it.
All right, let's get into pluses and minuses. What do you love about this game, and do you have any criticisms or worries about it?
Yeah, well, right before, I just want to say, so we this was a review copy that we were sent by Mindclash, and I really appreciate them sending it to me. I have already backed the Fractures of Time Legendary box, which comes with everything. So I am in for a penny, in for a pound, no matter what. I bought the whole thing. But they sent us a review copy because I reached out to them and said, you know, we would love to review just the base game. before the expansion comes out, but you know, I know it's going to be a long time. And they said, let us just send you this. So the reason they sent us a copy of this also is because there's a new edition of it out, which is called the Essential Edition. This has balance changes. It is cheaper. The original was almost $100. This is $55 full price. You can probably find it for less online. But if you buy it directly from them, it's $55. It takes away some of the expansion modules that were coupled in before, but the price is a lot lower. The barrier to entry is lower. Doesn't come with the fancy minis. You can buy those separately. I think it has some really valuable balance changes. Now, if you already have the original version, they are going to be selling a upgrade pack eventually, but you also don't totally need it. You can just download the new rule book. The changes are minor. They're not printed on the board or anywhere or any of the buildings. It's just some of the leader powers are nerfed or improved.
There was a consensus that the yellow faction was slightly weaker than the others, and it looks to me like good balancing, really.
Yeah, I didn't feel like anybody was weaker or stronger in my four or five plays of it so far. But yeah, I just want to say, you know, this is a review edition, but I also just want to say that, you know, the original Anachrony is out of print. So if this is a game you're interested in, it has a cheaper entry level to it. Then if you love it, you can decide to add on the beautiful exosuit miniatures, which, by the way, I did buy as a gift for you, Tom. Because you are going to be inheriting this Essential Edition, and I could not imagine you not having the beautiful miniatures, because I know how much you love miniatures.
You're so sweet. You're the best, man. That's awesome.
And the miniatures are awesome, because normally in the game, it's just a little hex that you put your worker token on. And in this one, it's these beautiful ornate miniatures that have a slot, and you slide your worker into the top of it, and you can see its head poking out the top. And it's awesome. It's so awesome. It's like you're like loading Ridley into the like freight loader. It's just so cool.
I feel icky just thinking about having that. Oh my god. Okay.
You're gonna love it. Okay, so I just wanted to mention what we're playing, how you can get it if you want, and that this was indeed a review copy supplied by Mindclash. If I quit my life as a screenwriter and dedicated myself to designing board games, I would find myself in direct competition with Mindclash games, because I think I would want to design the same types of games they make. I want heavy, heavy games with crazy out there themes that we have never seen before, where the theme shines as strongly through as the gameplay and the mechanics. And I think in Tricarion and in Anachrony, they have achieved that goal. And I adore those games. And so it's almost like they're designing games just for me. That being said, I am very glad there are expansions coming out, because I do think, even after my five games of this, that it would start to feel a little samey. There is a lot of asymmetry, of course, in variability and the things you can do. And I love the no pun intended, the gameplay loop of this. But it is a pretty basic worker placement tableau builder. And once you sort of get past the cool bells and whistles they've added to it, there is a very solid worker placement tableau builder there. But I think it starts feeling a little samey. It has the potential to, which is why we have some very exciting expansions coming out as well. So to me, that's it. I think there are potentially... I played one of the factions, Path of Salvation, and the whole strategy was collecting. I have to time travel. I have to time travel, and I have to collect the negative buildings, the anomalies. And actually, I didn't find it as enjoyable as the other paths because it just wasn't really my style of gameplay. I like to sort of build a more balanced tableau. That's always sort of what I try to do. I like to be able to do a little bit of everything. And this sort of was just like, here's what you do. You go hard on yellows. And if you have some spare time to pick up some points elsewhere, then you do it. And it didn't feel as creative or interesting to me as the other routes. Huh. But also, I don't know, after the game, I thought about it more and I was like, oh, if I had done this, it actually would have been a little more interesting. And so there's a lot of stuff to explore, but I think the game, for the amount of complexity it has, I don't think it has the timeless never get bored of it, always want to play again aspect that we would get from something like Gaia Project. But I think it could take as long to play and as long to teach.
Yeah, I'm what you said when you started off talking about this, when you were saying that this would be the type of game you would design, I was literally thinking the same thing a couple days ago. I was literally thinking, you know what? These guys do such a great job of putting story into their games, right? Making you feel like you are playing something that you feel like you're part of a story, which is not an easy thing to do in Euros. Particularly, and they really, really excel at it. From the production design to the fact that in this one in particular is telling a story. It has acts. There is a end of the second act disaster that happens literally in the game, and it's pretty amazing. My main concern about the game is the variability. I feel like I won the two games I played this week, and I felt in both cases when I was looking at it, I feel in both cases that I randomly picked this faction or that faction, and then the buildings were flipped up, right? And in both cases, the initial flip up of buildings were Yahtzee for me. They were just, oh my goodness, there are three things, I'm probably only going to be able to build two buildings this round, and there are three here that all are perfect for me, perfect. And that really gave me a leg up that never quite abated, right? Because the buildings that you choose become an engine for you, and if you can quickly and easily meet your evacuation conditions and get that out of the way, then you have so much more time, so many more actions. It is not hard in this game to meet your evacuation conditions. It is not hard to get a big evacuation bonus if you have a little bit of a leg up.
Yeah.
If the basis of the setup of the game, right? If the right super project comes out, if the right end game scoring conditions come out, it can be one of these things where the game kind of is helping you along and giving you extra actions that you can use to get a lot of points in these other areas that you normally wouldn't be able to do. Because the game is really good in the sense that you can't do everything. You can't, no matter what. And you have to really pick and choose, where am I going to get my points from? And sometimes what you think is the way you're going to score points, you end up realizing is swimming upstream because of the actions of the other players and because of just the way the game starts to develop over time. So my question is the randomness of the game too much for the strategy, for the strategic design of the game? Is the game throwing too many curves and too many wrenches out to make what should be a real strategic battle between players less strategic because the winner to some extent is the person that gets the more favorable setup? I don't know. It's far too early for me to say that that's the case, but I'm also really happy that there are so many expansions, and looking at some of these expansions and also looking at the balance that was done in this Essential Edition, I thought was great. I thought it was really well thought of. And I think the designers know what they're doing. And I have faith that in the expansions and in all of this, that they're going to find a balance to all that.
So it's funny because Tricarion to me is a perfect base game. I think Tricarion as a single box, single purchase base game is superior to Anachrony, just as the base game. And I think when you add in the expansions to Tricarion, it's potentially too much. It's potentially like that base game is almost the perfect level of weight and strategy. And
Dalguard's Academy. I'm sorry to interrupt. But Dalguard's Academy is a step too far for me. I keep trying to play it.
It could be.
And it's so much.
It is. I love it, but it is brain burnery to almost a painful level. Whereas to me, when I play base game Anachrony, I want my brain to burn a little more. I want to, you know, and so I'm wondering if maybe it has the opposite sort of issue where the expansion that's coming out hopefully by the end of the year called Fractures of Time, it makes it the perfect sort of quote unquote base game for me. It's going to add in a couple of really interesting things like blinking, which is where you can actually move your worker to a different space on the board. But the downside is it then opens up that space again for somebody else. So I think there could be more buildings being bought. There's a new resource that comes in that allows you to do that. It's very expensive. Your breakthroughs can now be used for other things on a whole other board. So I think it's going to add in some potential other strategies and some cool things going on.
It's got a sideboard with matter of fact, you mentioned Lorenzo. Just like Lorenzo, the expansion of Lorenzo adds a fifth tower. This adds a valley, which is a sideboard that adds a fifth line of action spaces. And there's a whole new faction. There is a whole new faction, the Path of Unity, that plays in a very different way.
And a whole new set of leaders for every single faction in the game, thus potentially making it, you know, wildly variable as well, because those leaders really change up the way you play.
Yeah, I guess with all of the caveats that we're giving, it says something about the base design of the game that we are jumping up and down, and we can't wait to get this expansion, because at the end of the day, we have played Anachrony and we want more. I think that's really what it comes down to, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And they are one of the must-buy companies for me. I mean, I've played an early version of Castaway Chronicles Perseverance, and it could be their best game. It's really strong, really interesting. And just the fact that it's multiple games that completely have nothing to do with each other in terms of, like, they don't require each other. They work as their own, but they can also connect to tell a larger story. I mean, they're attempting to do things narratively in board games that no one else is even playing with. And it's really exciting to me.
Yeah. And I'll say this about Anachrony. It is possible. I'm not going to say likely, but it is possible that because of the production values, because of the story that it's telling, because of the asteroid crash in the middle of the game, you might be able to convert some Ameritrash gamers over to this game.
Especially if you've got those minis.
Yeah, it's a complete Euro game. In no way, shape, or form does it have any design elements that are particularly Ameritrashy, but the coding, the dress that this game is put on, and to some degree the feel of it, right? That feel of telling a story, that's something that really attracts Amerithrash players and might very well hear. So if you got people that won't play Agricola with you because they want to play Blood Bowl, maybe pull this out and say, oh, you know, I was thinking of playing this with you, but no, you probably don't want to play it. You know, maybe they'll come over.
And the fact that it's a slightly lighter base game compared to Dracarion, like, I would never teach Dracarion to a non-Euro gamer just because it's a really beefy teach. But this is a notch less complicated just in the base game, right? I think you could get away with it.
Totally agree. That is Anachrony. There's the new Essential Edition coming out or out right now.
It's out now. It's mostly available directly through Mindclash. I think it's trickling its way into stores, but you can definitely order it directly from their website. Anywhere in the world, they'll ship it to you, I believe.
And their expansion is supposed to be coming out this year, so looking forward to that as well. Holy
Hopefully
cow.
By the end of the year.
Hopefully. Fingers crossed. And now we get to our member-specific segment. Maddie, what are we talking about? And why are you subjecting me to this?
You were not happy that this was the topic I wanted to bring up, because this is not interesting to you. But we are talking today about Zen and the art of setting up board games. Ooh. Now, I really love setting up a board game. It's one of my favorite parts of the game night. I usually try, if I know the game we're playing in advance, I will get to my office a little bit early before everybody arrives, and I will really meditatively set up a board game. I find it like building Legos, which was like my favorite thing as a child to do. I love following directions and watching as a beautiful picture unfolds before me. And that to me is what setting up a board game is like. I, the more complicated the game to set up, the better for me. I really love following the directions and making sure I set it up perfectly and getting that end result on the table when it's all laid out perfectly and everything's in lovely stacks and organized and everybody's player boards are out with all their meeples lined up in perfect little rows. It brings me great joy.
And for me, I'm you know, I'm fine with the over the close stuff, but I'm much more interested in what happens when we get down to action.
Sure, I understand. So I will say there are some games that I really love setting up, and there are some games that I don't. And then thinking about it, it actually was interesting to see the differences. So I love setting up anything by Mind Clash because it creates this beautiful board in front of me. And because it's just sort of simply follow the directions on the rule book, and it's not complicated to set up. So I can just sort of, I can really zen out. It's meditative. When I say the word meditative here, I'm being quite literal. I do find this as a mind clearing, calming experience. VTOL Lacerda game is exactly the same. It creates this beautiful picture by the end, and all I have to do is just follow the directions very simply. Gaia Project is another one as well. Games that I do not enjoy setting up, though. War of the Ring. I cannot relax when I have to find, okay, so four orcs and one troll go into Lothlorien.
Yeah.
All right, where's Lothlorien again? Look at the map. Now look back. There's so much cross-referencing. You have to be so focused to not make a mistake, because if you mess up one thing, it's going to throw the whole balance of the game off. I find that not fun. Gloomhaven. Sucks setting up. It's not fun building the map, finding the map pieces. Now it needs J4. Oh, wait, which one's J4? Oh, no, that's J3. Oh, and that's the other side. Oh, I can't find the big map. And then it's such a pain in the butt. Feast for Odin also. Oh, God. Okay. All the little pieces have to be on the gray board. And it's super annoying. So there are some games that are not fun. And the difference is that I want to turn my mind off when I set up a board game. I just want to follow the directions and be able to just let my mind wander and just slowly watch it unfold before me. And games where I have to be fully focused, or else if I make a mistake, it's going to throw off the whole game, is not enjoyable.
So, So for me, Antiquity, one of my absolute favorite games, is just horrible to set up. It is just, you know, there are so many little pieces to that game. So many times.
I just thought of the ultimate one.
Shall we tell the story?
tell the tale of the quake and the boats.
So Maddie had been saying for months that, you know what, I really have to play Roads and Boats. I've never played Roads and Boats. And I was like, Maddie, I'm dying to play it with you. The only reason we don't play it is that it is a bear to set up. It's so fiddly. There's so many pieces. It's actually not the easiest teach either. There's a lot to it. We're just gonna have to pick a night where we're not gonna have a normal game night. It's just gonna be you and me, and in this case, Alfred, and we're gonna get together, because I think Roads and Boats, I think 3 is probably the perfect spot for that game. Mm-hmm. And I'm gonna get out my Lucite, and I'm gonna, you know, place everything in the right place. Then I'm going to put it down on top of it and set the whole thing up. We get ready to play. I explain the rules. We're getting ready to go. We're starting to go. And how far did we get into the game? Did we?
I think you said, all right, so Roads and Boats. Let's start the pitch. And then
shake, shake, shake. Earthquake, earthquake, earthquake. And
the largest earthquake that we had in almost 10 years.
Yeah, it was a real shock. It was a real shaker. No question about it. No question about it. I mean, Alfred and I, you know, don't care about our loved ones, but you got on the phone right away.
Actually, well, my wife at the time, we had like a 4-week-old child, like, and she was home alone with our infant, our newborn, and our 1.5-year-old or 2-year-old. And, you know, it was like, she was like, you're coming home. And I was like, yep, bye, gotta go.
Alfred and I were screaming in the background, suck it up, suck it up, we'll be back later. No, I
also didn't want, because, you know, an earthquake, when you're born and raised in California, you've lived here long enough, you never think it's done. You always have to assume that's a pre-shock, here comes the big one. So, you know, I didn't want to take the risk of leaving my wife alone with our two very young children. The big one was about to hit.
Maddie, you don't have to explain yourself. I've mostly forgiven you. But it was those games, those early splatter games are beasts to set up and beasts to get going. But my favorite games to set up are games where the setting up of the game is a game in and of itself. So Wallenstein and Shogun, basically the same game with different theming, are amazing because there's your player mat has two sides. One side has these little camps that you put your armies on, and then the game is you flip up two location cards, and each player gets to choose between one of those two location cards, and then they choose any camp of their armies and place it on that space. So you're building the starting location, right? It's not three orcs go here and a ring wraith goes here. It's not that. It's you are choosing, and it's a kind of a tactical decision how the board is set up each game, and I think that's just brilliant. I absolutely love that.
I'm going to admit something now, Tom. This is a safe space for me to admit things.
Go for it. Do it. You are loved.
I've set up board games in the last few months just to set them up because I just
hate
them so much.
You are a psychopath, but it's safe. It's good. You're good. You're okay. It's all right.
I have been stressed out with work or life and just thought, I'm just going to set up a board game like it's game night. And it was so therapeutic and calming, and just to set it all up and then just to put it back in the box. And, you know, it gives me something to do with my hands, which is all is a part of how I meditate. I'm not a good just sit there, do nothing kind of person. I'm a take a walk and clear my head kind of a meditator.
Interesting.
So I found it to be a very therapeutic thing.
But
let's move into the next. Go ahead, sorry.
Sure, we can, but I do want to say, here's the one way we are alike. I hate it when I get a new game on a Friday because I know that there's a really good chance we're going to play it that day, and I do miss. I don't like seeing other people punching out my sprues. I don't like other people, you know, punching out my game. I'm like, I want to do that. I want to punch them out, and I want to set up the whole board, and I want to read the rule book, looking at the board and looking at the pieces. So for that first time, I'm 100%, I'm exactly like what you're describing. I do like the meditative thing of figuring it out. Once I've figured it out, though, I don't get the same charge in future setups, really.
Yeah, I understand. No, there is nothing more exciting than cracking the plastic on a new game and punching it all out. And I love the organizing aspect of it, which leads us perfectly into our next section, because you can't set up a board game if it sucks when you open the box and everything's all crazy jumbled around in there. How you organize your board games, how you actually find the state they are in when you open up the box, will dictate very often the type of experience you're going to have and how enjoyable it is to get that game to the table. There are many ways to organize a board game. Most board games, when you buy them, come with maybe a handful of little baggies in there with no guide to how to do it or what to do. And some of them come with thousands, literally thousands of cards and pieces. And it's up to you to find your own little way to organize them. Now, after 10 years of doing this, I'm like a machine. Like, I open this and my brain instantly starts doing all of these different things. Like, this will fit perfectly in a 5406 Plano. I'm going to need 14 medium-sized bags here. Like, I instantly just like visualize the entire thing. And I'm like, what's her name?
Maria Kondo.
The person who does, Maria Kondo. Like, I just instantly know how to like perfectly organize it in my head. But then there are times when you open a box and there's so many things and you go, man, this would be great if there was like an aftermarket insert for this that just had it all perfectly out there. And so I, for the last 10 years, have gone down the path of really trying out every single possible aftermarket insert, organizer, and storage option. And I'm going to tell you some of my favorites here. Now, Tom, before we get into that, though, Tom has a different idea of organizing his games. Yeah. Tom, do you want to say what you do?
I mean, my main strategy is the gallon bag strategy, because there's no game on the market today that all of the pieces don't fit in a gallon bag. So you just pour them in, and done. I mean, literally saving hours and hundreds or even thousands of dollars. I really highly recommend
The component drop that Tom Vassell does at the beginning of every Dice Tower review. Tom looks at that and goes, that game's ready to play.
That's how I put my games away. That is absolutely no, but this said, you have all of these things in these little Plano boxes and stuff like that. And guess what? Sometimes it's not easy to get the pieces out of those little Plano boxes, you know, and stuff like that. The ones that I figured out over time, that the ones that have the curved side, right, where you can sure. slide it out, those ones work. The other ones are useless to me. Whereas if I have...
It depends on the size of the chip, but yeah.
In all seriousness... I go to my 99-cent store, I get my snack-sized bags and my sandwich-sized bags because those are the only two you're ever going to need. I put each type of piece in that bag, I throw them in the thing, and the only other thing I ever get is I get those silicone cupcake molds. And when I pull them out of the bag, I pour them into one of those, and we're good to go. That's me.
Totally fine. And you know what? I will say this. Any money you spend on board game organizers could totally be spent on literally anything else. Anything else would probably be a better use of your money. Except I will say that there are certain games that it really helps the experience and gets to the table more. So if a $40 board game organizer, mm-hmm. which is what some of these things cost, mm-hmm. makes your $40 game get to the table five times as much as it would.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, true. Then maybe it was maybe you're getting a lot more value for that game. Then, you know, if a game is a beast to set up and you play it three times and it sits on the shelf forever and it stresses you out, if you spent another 30 or 40 to buy an organizer that makes you excited to play it, that might actually have been the actual cost of the game for you. And that's how I often think of it.
Manny, so, I heard a rumor that at the Broken Token offices, they have a 3D statue of you there. Is that true?
Well, sure. But I mean, that's outside of the plaque that they've named the building after, because I built four wings of that thing.
Is it true that they kiss your molded feet each morning before they go into work?
No, that's Meeple Realty that does that. So look, here's the thing also. A lot of games have gotten better with their inserts. When I first started in this hobby, there wasn't an insert to be found anywhere. Nobody did. You got an empty box, or if you were Fantasy Flight Games, you got that stupid cardboard thing with one, you know, World War I trench down the middle that holds what the hell that thing is for. And that was it. And you got nothing. The trays were crap.
Manny, but what does the inside of the Roads and Boats box look like?
Oh, it's just, I think it's just a middle finger. it's just like two like Scandinavians laughing at you. But these days you get some wonderful inserts that come in the games. I mean, most notably, all the VTOL Acerta games have pretty beautiful inserts. People have gotten better about it, but
I think the be all end all right now, my absolute number one insert for any game ever designed, I think the second edition Eclipse is crazy how good they did.
Yeah, they did a great job. Well, and here's the thing. I feel like they took some notes from Mind Clash, because the Tricarion Collector's Edition hands down the greatest insert I own them all. I own all the inserts, baby. And nothing beats the Tricarion Collector's Edition insert. It's shocking. I mean, it's just, you put it on the table and it looks like a work of art. All right, so let's talk about some of these companies. There are entire companies out there. There is a cottage industry around building aftermarket storage solutions for your board games. My favorite, the Cadillac of board game organizers, is a company called Meeple Realty. Why do I think they're the best? Well, because they are ridiculously over the top. I mean, they do create a VIP first class experience for your games. These are usually wooden pieces that you're going to be gluing together, but they're gorgeous. They designed them to be aesthetically pleasing. They're not just some ugly, you know, laser cut wood. They are meant to look like the game was designed around them, and often they are. officially licensed by the designers as well as the publishers. But they really do go out of their way to be aesthetically pleasing and beautiful. And they are expensive and completely unnecessary and wildly over the top. But if you love that game and it is your favorite game, I mean, there is no other way to store your game than with a Meeple Realty thing. And they have never sent me one thing free. In fact, I think I paid for all their children to go to college at this point.
Well, you have a Dominion a card holder that is made out of the very last Oregonian redwood, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah. No, it was the last tooth of a Bengal tiger.
that's your start player piece, right? That's what you.
All right, so Meeple Realty. Pricey, beautiful, incredible. They also just happen to make games, inserts for some of my favorite games. Next, I'm going to go to the budget version, which has sort of taken over. I now buy these for almost everything because they are so affordable. I almost feel like, why not? Folded Space is a company that makes inserts completely out of foam core. And so they usually cost about $15, maybe 10 bucks, 10 euros. They are a European company. They are located in Bulgaria. You order directly from them at very cheap prices, and it takes about a month to get to your house if you're in the States. But I do it all the time, and I usually buy four or five at a time. They're like 10, 15 bucks each. And they are remarkably well-designed and sturdy. And even though they're foam core, and you have to have a little bit of Elmer's glue to put them together, if you're like me, you enjoy that process of sitting down and listening to a podcast, maybe this one, while building a insert for your board game. And they're fantastic. And I've sort of, at this point now, unless I really love a game, unless it's my favorite game ever, unless it's Twa, you know, I'm buying the Fold and Space one for it because it's 10 bucks and it's like, it's great. It's totally fine. It's not pretty, you know, but it gets the job done. It does a really good job. So I recommend Folded Space as well. After that, you've got the two companies I've been doing it the longest, Broken Token and Go7 Gaming. They were around when I first got into this hobby 10 years ago. They're still going strong. They still make great stuff. They're just, you know, they're not Meeple Realty, and they're more expensive than Folded Space. But they definitely have a place here. And often these companies will do games that nobody else has done. So, for example, I just bought something from Broken Token. What did I just buy from them? Hold on, I have to look it up because now I'm forgetting what I bought. And I just bought it the other day, and I was so happy about it. I bought... I bought the Wingspan organizer from the Broken Token because nobody else had one, and I really wanted a nice organizer for Wingspan because my wife and I have been playing it a lot. And they had a fantastic one. So those are your main options. Outside of that, you're looking at Etsy. And Etsy has become, in the last couple of years, a really great place for board game designers because everyone and their mother owns a 3D printer now.
Yep.
And so people are using their 3D printers to make their own inserts. And they're usually pretty affordable. And they're usually made for games that, like these companies, like Meeple Realty, Folded Space, Broken Token, it's going to be a year or two until you get one for a game. So if you buy a game and you want an insert for it right away, someone on Etsy probably has it. And you're going to wait a year or two for Meeple Realty to get around to designing it. You know, maybe 6 months at the fastest. But if you just bought a game and you really want an insert for it and you don't want to wait for Meeple Realty and Folded Space and all of them to get around to it, Etsy is your place to go. And people are being very creative and actually coming up with some really cool stuff out there. Lastly, I will say the king of inserts in Europe is a company called eRaptor. They make some beautiful inserts as well. Shipping to the States is less than ideal because they are wood and beautiful and fancy. And I believe eRaptor is in Poland. So the shipping makes it usually impossible. Whereas Folded Space, you know, they're foam core and they weigh nothing. So they're pretty cheap to ship. And they ship them, you know, in like just little envelopes. But yeah, I've never paid for eRaptor because the shipping is almost as expensive as the organizers. But if you are in Europe, that is your place to go. And that's my overall look at that. The last thing I will say, Planos are fantastic. for the right game, like Tom said, there are some games where the chits get hard to come out. But Plano is a good way. If you go to, you know, the container store in the States, or you even just go to any fish and tackle place, you can get a lot of really great Plano boxes that will be perfect organization for a lot of your games, especially ones with a lot of chits. Uwe Rosenberg games go great with Plano boxes. And war games, I have a stack of GMT counter trays. Maybe once a year, I will go to GMT's website and buy, you know, for $10, I'll buy 5 GMT chit trays. And those are fantastic for storing chits in any war game, or I even use them for Roads and Boats. They're awesome and very inexpensive and great ways to organize.
And what's your secret for 18XX?
Oh, for 18XX, I use those jewelry holders for the tiles. But All Aboard Games, or not, sorry, Rails. Oh God, I have to remember the name of the company. There is Rails on Boards. So if you want some awesome special holders for your train tiles in 18XX games, a company called Rails on Boards has started designing some, and I think they're just started shipping. So go check those out. Lastly, let's just talk about organizing on the table. That's something I've sort of gotten into more recently because BGG has put out some wonderful organizing tools. They have their silicone cup / coasters, these wonderful little silicone coasters that fold up into beautiful component chit holders. For like $30, you can get like 15 of them. And I just have a giant stack of them, and people use them to put their drinks on them and fold them up into little cups to put components in. Those are great just to keep your table organized. And lastly, they also have these wonderful card and chit holders, these little long sort of thick silicone things that lie on your table that you can actually slide cards into that hold them up, sort of like a you know, I know bridge players use those little wooden things that hold cards in them. This looks like that, but it also has about 5 wells for your resources and stuff, which are really handy.
Yeah, I use the pieces from 10 Days in the USA, and those 10 Days games, I've got like about 4 of them. So I have tons and tons of those cards holders, but they don't have those little chit holders.
So the fun part about this whole thing, just to recap here, is that there are really budget-friendly ways to handle all these things. Like Tom said, you don't have to have the fancy BGG cup holder chits. You can just use those silicone molds people use for making cupcakes. They work great. There are lots of fun, creative ways to organize your space and do it in a budget-friendly way. You can get fancy and get Meeple Realty and get the fanciest, you know, Cadillac for your board games. Or you can, like Tom said, just go to the supermarket, buy a bag of baggies. And, you know, it's really about whatever makes it relaxing for you, whatever makes you feel like when you open that box, you're not going to be overwhelmed and stressed out, and you can get it set up in a way that gets you gaming quickly.
Supermarket. You buy baggies at the supermarket? I'm done with you. I'm done with you. I bought so many snack bags at the 99-cent store that one of the women at the counter recognized me and thought I was a drug dealer because evidently they buy them by the, you know, they buy thousands and thousands of the little baggies, right, for the dime bags or whatever. So literally thought I was a drug dealer.
Or whatever. Okay, Tom.
Listen, if it's not at the 99-cent store, it's not an organizer for me. That's me.
I love it. No, and that, see, I think, you know, that it's important to see the spectrum here, because you can be a crazy, wasteful money spender like me with stuff like that. But, you know, somebody who also has a lot of passion for it and loves it, or you can, there's ways to totally do it, without buying useless things. Well, and the board game insert is at the top of the list of useless things.
But now I have to own it because I feel like Pigpen a little bit. And when I come to your game night, it is such a luxury experience I can't begin to describe. Like when I choose, you know, you and I generally are not at the same table when we're gaming because each of us has to teach somebody oftentimes, right? Mm-hmm. And so at your game night, I open a box and everything is just the only pain in the butt is the unpacking of all of the perfect things that are already set up for you, which is amazing. It's like I'm going to a game spa. And then at the totally. And then at the end of the process, I start trying to put this stuff away, and you look at me and go, don't.
No, I don't let anybody put my board games away. Yeah, that's funny. Everybody's like, can we help you? And I'm like, no, you help me by leaving my house and letting me do it alone, because I'm the only one who knows how to put it back. And if you mess it up, it's going to bother me. And that's also a thing that the thing I get made fun of most for is that, like, you know how there's, when anytime you play a board game, there's stacks of chits all around the board and stuff. And I'm constantly grooming them and like making them look nice. And the way people torture me at the table is when I look away, when I look back, all the chits are scattered around and everybody waits for me to notice and like waits for my eye to start twitching. And, you know, OCD isn't actually a medical condition that I don't want to say I have, because I don't, but it, I definitely, really like things to be neat and orderly on the table. And, it doesn't pain me when they're not. I can live with it, but why not make it look nice if you can? So I'll often find myself grooming the board at all times, or I'll even reach over to somebody else's tableau if all of their chits and stuff are not nice, and I'll just, when they go to the bathroom or something, I'll organize it for them.
I may have started the trend of intentionally moving things askew, and for that I apologize. it's a wonderful little side game to play for people that don't actually listen. If OCD is a spectrum, you're on the spectrum, but it's not something that seems to cause you pain. It's just something.
No,
that
I don't want to diminish
preference.
People who actually have OCD. Yeah. But
but my whole point for this is that when I'm
anal retentive. Let's say that.
my whole point of this is that even though I don't do that, I don't dip my toe into that sort of thing, and I'm fine with plastic baggies and cupcake holders. When I come to your game night, I very much appreciate the experience, and the upgrade of that experience is immediately evident to me. So there you go.
Well, thank you. There you go. Two sides of the spectrum.
It is. Both now. Very much so. Very much so. Pigpen and whatever the heck you are. Linus, I guess.
Yeah. We're the odd couple.
Yeah, very much so.
We're the board game odd couple. Yeah.
And my games are pristine, though. They're in really good condition. I don't let bad things happen to them. We didn't even
talk about sleeving. That'll be a whole other episode.
Yeah, we are on opposite sides of that, for sure.
I sleeve like crazy.
Oh, I feel like you are putting condoms on things that are not meant to have condoms. It's just
I hear you.
Horrible. You know what? That's where you are thriftier than me, because I will buy a new copy of the game when the cards get old rather than sleeve them.
Yeah, no.
So that's what I will do. I will purchase the game again to get a fresh deck of cards, and I have no problem with that. I mean,
if you buy a used copy from me, you are getting a brand new copy. Basically, no,
I would buy a game from you in a heartbeat. I'm like, this is like 20 times better than any game I own.
Oh yeah. No, they are pristine.
Shall we do a board game sommelier, Matt?
Shall we? Let's.
Sometimes a player just got to know which game should stay. Which game should go? Which to play with mama, madame, abu? You got to tell me, monsieur, just what to do. Want to make an impression, but I can't get far with my 50th play of Agricola. A million games, show me the way to the master, the game sommelier.
I'm so excited that Alfred said that he could drop a little backbeat on that and spruce that up. I would love to hear what he does to that. Our word game sommelier is from Oscar Johansson today, and it says, I've recently gotten to your pod and like it a lot. Thanks, man. You seem to enjoy much the spectrum of games that me and my game group enjoys as well. Arboretum, Trois, CO2, Concordia, Agricola, etc. So I think the game sommelier might have some good advice when it comes to an area I've not explored much. War games, which is perfect because we were just talking about Versailles. The only war games that I actually enjoy is Twilight Struggle and Twilight Imperium, though for the latter, I do not think the war aspects interest me that much, as much as acquiring land, fulfilling goals, and managing resources. Do you have a suggestion for war games that would suit mid to heavy Euro gamers? I don't care much for the war theme. It's if the games had war mechanics that play a significant role that I'm after. and especially, I think, games with interesting war mechanics. Root and Maria seem to be interesting games on my radar. Scythe, for example, seems a bit light on the war aspect, so I'd be looking for something else. Lots of meows. Oscar. Oh, well, we got some. Do it.
I have two words for you, Oscar. Volko Runke. I think Volko is your man here. The designer of Coin Games, which I think are fantastic Euro war game hybrids. I think the best entry point at this point is probably Falling Sky or Cuba Libre.
Cuba Libre, more. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And his new series, Nevsky, is a beautiful, strange game about Levy, and it's called the Levy and Campaign series, and it's all about the economics of supply routes for armies, and it's wonderful and beautiful and complicated. Those are great Euro-heavy war games that don't feel like war games.
Excellent. Yeah, couldn't agree more. Those I had Coin Games on my list as well. So you mentioned you love Twilight Struggle. You're going to love Imperial Struggle. I probably don't need to tell you that, but you absolutely need to get into that. You mentioned Maria, and Friedrich and Maria both are astonishingly good games. Really simple to learn, really deep to play. Kind of amazing. Friedrich is even easier to understand. And the reason I love Friedrich more than Maria, I think Maria is probably the better game, but I love Friedrich because it is asymmetric. It's basically one player fighting against three other players, and very unique in that sort of sense. Memoir 44, going way, way back, is a fairly simple, you know, there's dice rolling, all that sort of stuff, but there's a decent amount of strategy in it. So if you wanted to look at something much more medium weight that still was a war game and interesting, we didn't talk about the Undaunted games, but those games came out of nowhere and are really, really, really solid. And Maddie, how did you not mention, how did you not mention War of the Ring? How did you not say that?
Because that's just a straight up war game. I mean, that's just a war game of all war. I mean, if you want that, there's nothing Euro about that to me.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say Churchill, but now that Versailles is out, you might want to look at Versailles because it is really great. Getting deeper, Hannibal Rome versus Carthage began the card-based war game. So knowing Twilight Struggle, you could pick up Hannibal Rome versus Carthage. It's amazing, and you could pick that up pretty easily. And just two other games that are really, really unique that are in this space are Sekigahara and Triumph and Tragedy. So
great. Those are great.
Crazy, crazy good, interesting games. What we did there is we between the two of us, we picked the games that are the least wargamey that still are really interesting designs that came from the wargame space. And when you start checking those out, you'll figure out for yourself how deep down that that rabbit hole you want to go. But they're really, really great.
You are living in the golden age of wargame Euro hybrids, luckily.
Yeah, you really are. You really are. Maddie, love this episode. Really enjoy having you back, man.
So fun.
You've been missed.
So fun.
You've been missed. And
who's doing next week? Are you doing next week, or am I doing next week?
I think you're doing next week, if that's okay. If you're good for that.
What am I doing? Am I doing Paul?
I think so.
I think I'm doing Paul, and we're going to review Fort, I believe.
Oh, amazing! Amazing. Can't wait.
Maybe we can get you on a Fort game this week at some point,
dude. I'm in 100%.
You got to catch up with the meta. We've got quite a meta going.
I don't mind being stupid for the first couple games. I'm okay with that. Then we'll figure it out. We have a YouTube channel, youtube.com/C/GameBrainPod. A Facebook group. I would go there just to look up the inanity of our cup of noodles Yahtzee conversation. and our Discord channel, and please get in Board Game Sommelier questions. We are getting to the bottom of the barrel there, and you're listening to Game Brain, produced and edited by Matthew Robinson and Tom Donnelly. Special thanks to Daedalus for our incredible music. You know him as Alfred. More on Daedalus at GameBrainPod.com. You can also reach us by email at contact@GameBrainPod.com or on Twitter at GameBrain_pod. That's where to send those Sommelier requests. And thanks for listening, and go play some games with friends online or Maddie. virtually.
Go play some friends with games. Virtually go make some friends with games virtually. Damn, I'm new.